I'm Doug Fabrizio. The film and culture critic Wesley Morris tells this story to explain how these seemingly harmless but racist ideas are embedded in our culture and how difficult it is for people to shake them off. He told this story to us last month in front of a live audience. This was for our speaker series. Morris is African American, and he was going to dinner with some friends. This was at a restaurant in Marfa, Texas.
Our friend who was living in Marfa had discovered this place that she likes to go, and it's in a big, grand, sort of manse-like house. And we got there, and we go through the front door, and I mean, I'm not even through the threshold, and I see it. Her. There's a big porcelain statue of this black woman, and your classic sort of minstrel era caricature of a black caretaker. The stereotypical name for this person would have been Mammy. And they were called Mammies by the white children and the people who hired them that, you know, these women worked for. But, you know, we order, I'm like, do I say something? Because I'm in a mixed group and I've had people fight racism on my behalf. Like, I've been there. Like, maybe today's not the day that we put this woman's restaurant out of business if that's where this goes. And so I was just like, I'm not going to say anything. But then I, like, kept turning around and looking at it. It's like she was talking to me. There were no other black people in this restaurant. I was the only black person in this space, me and the woman at the door. I just got really indignant. Like, we're the only two people in here, and one of them is holding the door open. The longer I sat and, like, the food came and, like, my friend was like, why aren't you eating? I was like, you know what? I gotta tell you guys, I can't eat this. I can't eat this and I'm not paying for it. She needs to know that thing has gotta go. Maybe I have to go. I mean, because she's not going to move that thing. I know it. Whitney knew the woman who owned the restaurant. It was her family's house. And Whitney calls her over and she says, we're just kind of wondering about the figurine by the door and why she's there. And the woman is like, you mean Mammy? Oh, well, I love Mammy. Mammy reminds me of my Mammy who took care of me and the Mammy who took care of my mother. And I was like, well, ma'am, if she's so important to you, why is she holding the door open? Why isn't she on a pedestal or on a niche or something? She's like, well, I just want her to greet everybody. And I want everybody to greet her. I mean, she was really upset that we were upset. And I, just listening to how, like, hurt she was that I was hurt. I mean, I had no sympathy for this woman at all, but I did have a kind of sympathy for the lives of people who are allowed to tell themselves lies about the lives they were allowed to have as the result of something like this woman holding this door open.
Yeah.
There was no way in the world I was ever going to make her understand that restaurant is probably still open and that figurine is probably still at that door. And I don't think she should have to move it, honestly. I was just sad that I could not impress upon her, like, what my relationship is to that figurine.
For Morris, the story brought up feelings he's been working through for a long time now. The same kinds of feelings that came up when he saw the 2011 film, The Help. It's about a white woman writing a book about the black women who work in the white households of Mississippi in the 1960s. Morris believes movies are part of a larger conversation about how we live our lives, so he feels a moral obligation to say something. And it was the power dynamic on display in The Help that just bothered him.
I thought about that watching this movie where these, like, very good black actresses were then hired to basically play a version of that woman's memory and the figurine holding that door open. And I just could not get my brain around what it was like to shoot a movie under those circumstances if you're Octavia Spencer or Viola Davis or Anjanou Ellis or any of the other black women in that movie. What it must have been like to sort of inhabit these roles that are what the movie is actually about, but the movie can't happen unless there's a white person pulling the strings and telling the story, right? I don't know. Like Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer are really good. Octavia Spencer won an Oscar for playing this part, but it just made me sad because it's a mess. It's tricky and it's hard. It's easy to be upset, but it's hard to only be upset.
Today in Radio West, Wesley Morris talks about how our attitudes about race can be reflected in popular culture. Morris joined us last month as part of our speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his work in 2012 when he was writing for the Boston Globe. These days, he's a critic at large for the New York Times. I had read that as a kid growing up in Philadelphia, Morris watched a lot of movies, but he has said at the time he was perfectly fine watching white people on the screen. So I asked him about it.
I mean, I'm assuming that I knew I was watching white people. I just don't think I cared, right? I was watching movies and yeah. they star white people. My mother, I should say, was a big movie lover. She watched a lot of movies. And then by extension, so did I. One of her favorite movies was Imitation of Life. And it's about it's kind of complicated, but basically it's about a black girl who is passing for white and the problems that causes. There's a moment in the Douglas Sirk version, who has not seen Imitation of Life? I don't want to ruin it. All right, that's enough people. That's a plurality. I'm really not going to ruin it. I'm just going to say that at the end, Mahalia Jackson shows up and she sings. And Douglas Sirk is one of our great filmmakers ever. He's also the greatest melodrama director of all time. And so he knows how to milk a moment for all of its sort of emotional power. And without fail, every time this movie came on, whether we had been there at the beginning or whether my mom had turned on American Movie Classics and we were actually at the Mahalia Jackson scene, my sister, if she was around, my mother and I would just start crying. And it was automatic. And so I understood, there are two things I understood. So I understood that movies had this power. I'm a kid who I cried at all kinds of weird movies. I cried at Misery. At the end, I cried at E.T. a bunch of times. But I never really watched the movies as a kid understanding or aware of the way race worked.
Yeah.
And the only times it really occurred to me is when you would see black people in these AMC movies and they weren't doing anything remotely as interesting as the white people were. And I was at like 9, 10, and 11 years old enough to recognize that there was this like narrative discrepancy between what the white people were doing and what the black people were doing. And what the black people were doing in these movies that a kid could see and be disturbed by was serving the white people.
Yeah.
And why was that? And why were there no movies on American Movie Classics with any black people? That realization came a little bit later. But it stuck with me, and not in a way that made the experience of watching those movies less pleasurable, but it just began to tell me a story about a thing that was true in culture that also was true in life. I grew up in a poor neighborhood in Philadelphia, in like geographically Northwest Philadelphia, and I just understood that there was very little culture except for things like The Cosby Show, and we got cable eventually, and we had BET. There was very little culture that actually featured non-white people.
Yeah.
Or the black people were doing anything as interesting as the white people were doing. And
but it doesn't sound like you were outraged by that, or were you?
Look, I was nine. Right. I mean, that would have been amazing if I had gone to school and be like, you know what? F Betty Davis. I don't want to watch another Greer Garson movie because I'm tired of watching people serve Greer Garson. Why can't Greer Garson serve me? I would have been a really awesome.
I guess what I'm wondering though is like, how much of wanting to eventually be a critic was about saying something beyond just I want to say something about film. Like, when did the not the activist part, because you don't consider yourself an activist in the work that you do, I don't think.
I really don't. Like, yeah. I'm just saying things that are true. Yeah. I mean, that's not, like, not to say that an activist doesn't do that, but I'm also, I don't have to do a lot of work to say that. Like,
right.
Yeah. I mean, y'all don't have to be convinced, but, I mean, I don't have to hit the streets to do it, right? I'm just, this is just life. An activist is, like, actually trying to make changes. Like, I mean, I hope that I can change some things, but yeah, no, I'm just calling it as it is.
When you go and watch a film, one of the things you've talked about, I imagine you do this when you read a book or maybe when you watch TV, is that you're taking notes. You always take notes.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that about? Is it, even when you're not writing a piece about it, you're taking notes. Are you just a natural observer? Are you, like, I'm trying to get at what you think the gift is about the part that makes you such a good critic? Is it just the writing part? Is it the observation part? Is it the connecting the dots part?
I think it's probably all of those things. I mean, I can sit here and talk about what I think makes a critic generally good, and then I could tell you what I think I'm good at. Hmm. But I mean, there are people who don't like it when I put it this way because they think I'm not, like, giving myself credit for the work that I do. But it is kind of magic, right? Like, I know how I feel when I watch something. I know because I'm taking notes while I'm watching it or listening to it, or, like, you know, I'll be in a restaurant and want to, like, take some notes because something will occur to me. Something is always occurring to me. Hmm. But sometimes the magic really is, like, the things my brain thinks about. I have knowledge. I'm educated. I'm smart. I know things. But I can't control what my brain really does with that knowledge, right? Like, the thoughts just occur to me, and I am lucky enough to be in a position to be able to use those thoughts to, like, make arguments and tell stories and go further in the thinking.
Hmm.
But it's really kind of this alchemical thing that I really can't explain.
How much do you figure that a person can learn about race in America if they just were looking at popular culture?
Oh, everything. It's all in there. Everything that has happened in the last 400 years has happened in popular culture. Even when the stuff doesn't know it's actually doing it, it's in there. And the thing that I love about popular culture is it frequently doesn't even know how it's actually connected to all this other historical stuff, right? It is the direct result of all that history. It is the beneficiary, if you're watching American movie classics, of all that history, even as it attempts to tell versions of stories of that history. It's different with books.
Hmm.
There's something about movies and music where, you know, because you're watching and listening to something on the one hand, it's kind of easy to just not think about how far back into the past something happens to go when it's set in the very present. But these stories and these problems don't come from nowhere. They're very much rooted in these problems that the country has always had. And then by extension, American popular culture just happens to accurately reflect a lot of those problems, sometimes and often by accident.
So it reflects what's happening. Does it create what's happening? Like, how much power does popular culture have to create attitudes and bigotry and inequality? Or is it just reflecting back on something that's already happened? Or is it all a mishmash?
I struggle with that.
Huh.
Because I actually don't think that, I mean, I'm really not a big, like, video games made me do it person.
I was just going to ask you about this.
I don't really know where the exact fault lines are in the situation. But, like, I can stand on some data here, like, and say that, like, there's lots of research to say that the video games are not the problem, right? there's this other stuff. I played hours of video games when I was a kid. I mean, hours. I went to a boarding school, and I would come home on the weekends, and, you know, I missed my mom a lot, but at some point, my mother, we just sort of fall into the usual habits of a mother and a kid. My mother wanted her alone time, and I wanted to be alone, and I sat in my room and listened to the radio. I'm talking, like, from, like, nine. I didn't go outside. There were many weekends where I would sit in my room from, like, 9 a.m. I'd wake up earlier than that, but I think I'd probably get going at about 9 a.m.
Right.
And I would go till the sunset. I'd listen to the radio. I'd listen to music. I'd listen to cassettes. I mean, a lot of my knowledge of, like, really, really minor pop music comes from having had the radio on for, I would say this started in maybe like the fourth grade and went till I graduated from high school, like playing video games. So, I mean, I've never really had an urge to, like, act on killing somebody. I just want to throw that out there. So there's clearly some other factors that go into this, because video games are our number one industry, and we'd have a lot more problems on our hands if that's the cause. So I think popular culture is a reflection of who we are, but, you know, this stuff does come from actual individual people, mm-hmm. right? It comes from people's actual imagination to have ideas and thoughts about things. And so it usually is more reflective, but obviously it's popular culture. It is mass culture, and it does have the power to sort of shape opinions and feelings about things. I mean, I remember seeing Mississippi Burning, for instance, just to pick one very specific example, and watching that movie and just being like, well, guess the FBI solved the civil rights movement. Guess Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe saved black people. That is a thing the movies can do. The movies can tell any story the movies want. And our first great American movie is The Birth of a Nation, right? This is a movie that basically, has anybody seen this movie? I mean, wow, that's more than I've ever seen. That's more hands I've ever seen go up for that movie ever. Congratulations, you guys. But this is a movie that...
It created a template, you said.
Well, it more than creates a... I mean, yes, it creates a template, but it also is just a really great example of the power of a medium, the power of a director's vision. I mean, I watched that movie and was like, oh, I don't know about black people. I just don't know. I don't know. Can we trust them? I don't know if we can. I really don't know. We should maybe exterminate them all. Like, that is the power of the movie. So that movie comes out of American history.
Yeah.
But it is making its own history and making its own arguments without needing to, like, create anything, right? Although it was the first, you know, major motion picture.
Let me ask you about another kind of a different version. These racial reconciliation fantasies that you've been writing about. So let me ask you, first of all, when Green Book won.
Sorry.
I know how Spike Lee reacted. How did you react? Like, where were you? How did you react when you...
I got to tell you, this is real petty, but I'm always wrong about the Best Picture winner. I have what I call an Oscar dream, where, like, on the night before the nominations, I'd have some dream where I thought, like, the most impossible nominee would get nominated. I didn't need to have that dream this year, because last year when I saw that movie, I was like, ding, 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 ding.
That's getting the Oscar.
That's your Best Picture winner. I never had that feeling, but I knew it because I watched it with an audience, and I saw
a white audience. Can you tell?
It was mixed. Listen, yeah. Everybody loves Green Book. It's not a white. It's not just white people. It's people in my family, because the thing that it advocates is a thing that we should all want, right? If you just look at it for what it actually is saying, it's saying. I mean, at a time in American history where such a thing really would cost you your life, it is saying that this stupid white man and this very educated, intelligent, classy black man can forge a friendship against all of the social odds and against the white man's own racism, they can be friends. And when they finish this road trip and this white man has saved him from like racism over here, like lessened some racism that he could have faced over in this other place, and then sort of stood up for him against these other racists, he's experienced all that. We as an audience have seen him experience all that. So when Mahershala Ali as Don Shirley is sitting at home in his amazing apartment above Carnegie Hall by himself, rather than have Christmas dinner with his Indian helper, who he sends home to be with his own family, obviously, and Don Shirley has no family in this movie, he decides, I'm going to go and hang out with Tony. I'm going to go to Tony's family. And I can understand why that is a very satisfying conclusion to a movie that is so well made that there's a way to watch it and feel what the Academy felt, right? And to feel what many other people who've seen this movie felt. I just call because not to be all, it's 2019, but it is. I don't mind. Obviously, there's a lot of great storytelling to be done by going back to the past to do it. But I also think that this movie is about these two men, but Don Shirley is literally riding in the backseat of a story that half belongs to him. I knew it was going to win because the thing that's amazing about the movie in some ways is you could never have Mahershala Ali play Viggo Mortensen's part because people would just go crazy that Mahershala Ali is just like, he's part of the minstrel show. He's just like hamming it up and cooning it up for these white people. So what they do is they make the white person the black guy and the white guy the black person. And the fried chicken scene is the like the apotheosis of that, right? Mm. Where like now you've got these two people with the races reversed, and I'm in my mind watching it comparing it to Driving Miss Daisy, because it is Driving Miss Daisy. But you have in this fried chicken scene, for anybody who has not seen this movie, there's a scene where Tony Villalonga, who's played by Viggo Mortensen, this Italian guy from, is it Queens or the Bronx? It's the Bronx. So they go, they're driving, they're in the South at this point. He goes and gets some fried chicken. He's like, oh, this fried chicken's delicious. You should have some fried chicken. And Don Shirley, to the shock of the comedy of the scene, by the way, is predicated upon the idea that there's a black man in America who's never had fried chicken. That's the comedy of the scene. That's the joke, right? And the brilliance of the way that the scene is written and directed and acted is that there are like four different punchlines in this 5-minute scene. And the scene only works if you understand what the stereotypes are supposed to be and how this wouldn't be funny if the races were reversed. And I actually don't have a problem with the scene as craftsmanship, right? My problem is it's predicated upon a thing that I have to say is impossible. Like, I don't know. It just really, really bugged me that throughout the entire movie, Tony is supposed to be blacker and more in touch with his own blackness than Don Shirley is, and has to keep educating Don Shirley about what it's like to be black. And how does Don Shirley learn what it's like to be black? He has to like undergo Southern racism to get it. And we know that Tony's a racist in the first couple of scenes because we watch him throw the cups out after the repairmen come and drink off of them and leave the house. We know he's a racist because everybody in his family's a racist. But the movie's sort of weird sleight of hand, the sort of sickening, nauseating, morally disgusting sleight of hand, is that Tony's racism is less awful than Southern racists because Southern racists use the right words, right? Nobody knows what a mulignong is in English, but everybody knows what an N-word is, right? It's just, I don't know. I'm tired of being mad at this movie, but it's so easy to be mad at it. But I also I don't know. Like, my sister saw it a week after it won the Oscar. She's like, I like that movie. That was good. I was like, okay.
Well, here's what you wrote about it. You wrote it does nothing to address or acknowledge the infrastructural problems that keep the races divided. In fact, it makes it worse. And I wanted to ask you about that part. That, and this is something that we, in terms of when you're dealing with equity or equality, any of trying to address it, we in this series, we've heard from people, Jelani Cobb was talking about how we just don't want to talk about it. And is that the reason that we want to resolve racism and feel good about it, and we're not facing, we want racism to go away, I think is another thing you put in the piece. We just want to feel like it's resolved. We don't want to deal with the problems, or what is it?
Okay. Well, let's just stay with Green Book for a second. The movie is called Green Book. If you watch the movie, it kind of explains what the Green Book is, but it's a handbook for motorists, for black motorists, to find safe harbor on the road when driving below the Mason-Dixon line, to know that they can sleep safely at night and eat in certain places where they also won't die, where they'll be welcomed for one thing, and also won't be harassed, killed, I was going to say, or worse, but, you know, or worse. The movie doesn't care. Why is it called Green Book? I mean, why isn't it called, like, Tony and Don, two best friends? Or, like, we fixed it. But they called it Green Book, which maybe to me might be the most offensive thing of all, because the book, that was more than a help manual. It was a like 40 pages of 911. And why not tell the story of this book and why it was important? That's the infrastructural injustice that does not, like, the movie does not have the either historical awareness, faith in the American audience to, like, to be able to understand. I don't know why they didn't do it, because it's unwieldy and it doesn't fit into the, like, the neat little trick the movie's trying to pull. At some point, Don is using the actual pamphlet to write stuff. He's using it as a notepad. I mean, there's kind of a disrespect show in this thing. I mean, I don't know how actual black motorists treated it, but we don't see any black motorists use it. The person using the Green Book in the movie is this white guy. But that sort of thing is a thing that happens in the movies all the time, where the thing the movie actually should be about, I mean, Mississippi Burning is another example of that. That movie is actually about those three civil rights workers who got killed, not the FBI agents who solved the case. I don't know. I don't. Why am I watching this movie? Well, it's well made, for one thing. Alan Parker's a very good director. But morally, like, why am I watching this movie about these two guys go and, like, Gene Hackman gets to fall in love and have sex with Frances McDormand is being beat up by her, like, KKK husband? Like, where are we?
You did this extraordinary piece for the 1619 New York Times podcast project, which is remarkable. And you talk about this moment, as you put it, the night American popular culture is born. And it's this Jim Crow character who is playing for a crowd, and the crowd goes crazy. He happens to be a white man who's got painted his face.
Yeah, Thomas Dartmouth Rice is the guy's name. T.D. Rice.
T.D. Rice.
This is, you know, legendary stage name.
And in the piece, you ask the question about, like, what was so, here's how you put it, what was so captivating about seeing black people represented this way? Get started this black minstrel movement, white performers in blackface. And you said it provided a platform by which white people could either escape from actually having to think about, you know, the bigger question about what was really tearing the nation apart.
Which was slavery. Right.
Or it would fully engage them in the lightest possible way about enslaved people. Would you talk a little bit about that? It was a platform for making white people feel better about themselves, less guilty about what they were seeing in front of them.
Well, I did just say the thing I said about Birth of a Nation, right? And, like, the power of that movie, watching it as a black person, I mean, I 100% know that the movie is wrong. I'm just dramatizing the movie's power over an audience. And I think that blackface minstrelsy, when it was practiced starting in like 1830, is a very similar phenomenon. Minstrelsy is a lot of things. It's strange, right? You have these white men who go through it like a not simple procedure to like get their faces black. Then they have to go out and perform. It doesn't exactly, like, it runs a little bit when you sweat, because if you're working as hard as some of these guys worked, it would run a little bit. Then you got to take it off at the end of the night. And that's a labor. There's something about the ritual, if you're somebody like T.D. Rice, of doing that night after night after night. And he was somebody who I would say is practicing racism without, this is tricky, but just bear with me. It is a thing where the art form that he was helping invent became so much bigger than the problem it was creating and propagating. Mm. And there's an erotics to this impersonation of black people, where for all of the killing and humiliation and torture and degradation that particular white people did of black people, there was still a hunger to watch a version of them. And it wasn't like every show featured horrible things happening to black people. Sometimes it was just a show where people just happened to be in blackface. I mean, just happen again. It's a laborious process. Nobody just falls into blackface. But the humiliation of black people wasn't the explicit point. But for like 70 years, that was what you'd see if you on many occasions, if you went out on a Friday night and got a babysitter to have some entertainment, you'd be watching some people in blackface just give stump speeches, like fake stump speeches. It wasn't only a campaign to make black people seem stupid or lesser than. That was always sort of built into it, but that's not the only thing it was. Like there were poetry readings and stuff like that with people in blackface. It was just how people went on stage. And it's also the beginning of where most of our stereotypes about black people start too. Every accidental bad thought or on purpose bad thought you have about a black person, it just comes out of minstrelsy. You know, horny, dangerous, stupid, really into being enslaved. All of those ideas are part of the Minstrel Project. And again, it went on for a long time and then extended into the creation of American movies. To the extent to your earlier question about the power of American culture to shape ideas, I mean, there's a popular culture art form or form that, you know, is almost entirely responsible for helping propagate these ideas about black people. And, you know, white people as being superior to them under those circumstances. Yeah.
Wesley Morris, he's a critic at large for the New York Times. He joined us last month for a live conversation, part of our speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. Next Wednesday, we're hosting the final event in that series. The activist Brittany Packnett will join us. She's a podcast host and has been at the forefront of the Black Lives Matter movement. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. This is Radio West on KUER.
This week on Preach, the two guys who met on a Bible college puppet team and then built a Christian media empire.
Hi, kids, and welcome to VeggieTales. I'm Bob the Tomato.
And I'm Larry the Cucumber.
VeggieTales is a cartoon that used wacky singing vegetables to teach kids about the Bible. It was huge in the 90s, and then it went bankrupt. Now it's making a comeback. Listen to Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with New York Times critic Wesley Morris, recorded live last month at the University of Utah.
So I have to say, I loved Warner Brothers cartoons.
Yeah.
Like, loved them.
Well, didn't we, don't we all?
And then when you watch them now, almost all of them, or many of them, seeing the blatant racism and the racist stereotypes in them made me think of the question, and you could apply this to any sort of Gone with the Wind, any sort of classic, quote unquote.
Gone with the Wind's like a nice version based on what you'd see in cartoons.
It's true. But what are we supposed to do with that stuff now?
Well, understand what you're watching, for one thing. I mean, I am not a banish it, make it go away, you know, don't ever watch it. No, you should know what our entertainment was and, you know, what our animators and storyboard artists and writers were up to. I remember watching a lot of Tom and Jerry, and when you're a kid, at some point you do become aware of what you're not seeing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, funnily enough, in Tom and Jerry, you're never seeing this black woman who's always saying, "Thomas!" But you see her fat ankles, and you see her, like, brown skin, and I don't remember if the stockings are rolled down or up, but you see only part of this woman's body. But you are fully aware that you are experiencing a black person in a caretaker's role. It's not her house. I don't know why, as a kid, I just knew it wasn't her house, but I have been so institutionalized and conditioned to understand that I would never be watching culture that would take place in the house of a black woman. I just knew that this was not a black woman's home. It was a white woman's home. But why did she need to be there? There's no narrative reason for a Tom and Jerry cartoon to need that woman to do that thing, you know, to like sort of sweep it at Jerry with a broom because, oh my God, a mouse. There's so many examples of things like that that just nobody is asking for, but because they're there, if you're inclined to notice and then be curious about or disturbed by, you're inclined to deal, you have to deal with them. But I mean, most people watch that stuff and just think, oh yeah, two brown legs. And think nothing of it. And it's the thinking nothing of it part that I feel a responsibility to try. To the degree that I'm an activist, it's the not thinking about it part that I want to try to do something about. It isn't that you have to overthink it, but you just have to notice it. And it doesn't make the Tom and Jerry experience less bad. It just makes you wonder why the experience has to be that way. That's so much of American popular culture. If we're talking about indigenous people, we're talking about Asians, we're talking about Latinos, gay people, just the disabled, like pick a group and there'll be so much. Even the things that purport to be doing the right thing are not doing it right enough. And a lot of that has to do, I mean, you know, I know we're talking about equity and you know, who has a stake in certain aspects of the creative process. I wonder, I'm not going to sit here and be like, well, all of this would have been fine if, you know, Berry Gordy were doing it. You know, I'm not, but we don't know. I don't know. Maybe it would be different. I mean, there's just no, we have no counter example to know how it would be because it's only ever been one way the whole time. So there's plenty of room in there to imagine this other way that isn't a replacement or a displacement of people currently doing things. We're talking about expansion,
yeah.
and bringing more people in to just think and create and see what comes out of that. Because we know some version of how it went for 100 years, longer than that, but I'm talking about like sort of mass visual culture.
So if we became better at seeing these things and correcting, I know you worry about overcorrecting. You've written a little bit about that.
I do.
But I guess the question is, can popular culture, is it powerful enough to fix this?
You mean the 400 years of systemic and infrastructural racism? No, but I mean, I don't think, again, like that the answer being yes would need me to have said earlier when you asked the sort of corollary question about the role and power of popular culture to shape and mold and influence. Blackface minstrelsy was, at the end of the day, a form of propaganda, right? It made one group of people look one way, and it made another group of people look one way. And the people, the objects of the blackface had no stake in any aspect of that performance. Even when, as black people, they were performing in blackface, it took a while for them to be able to figure out a way to still do it, but also be able to sort of like what we now would call code switch, what my grandmother would say, talk out of both sides of their mouths. Part of the problem is that, like, especially with movies, there's so much popular culture that wants to change things and wants to make a difference. Stop trying to make a difference. Just make art. Like, the art will be the thing that the art is, and sometimes the art will make a difference. But it's, no, I'm a big laws person. Pass some laws. Don't ask the movies to do your legislator's job. Just don't. And I feel like, well, that's basically the answer to your question. I don't have anything more to say. I mean, it's just true. Like, the government is one thing and popular culture is something else. The thing that is happening right now in terms of when we're talking about canceling people and we're talking about making people go away and we're trying to, like, stop people from creating entertainment or saying more when they shouldn't say what they're saying. The reason that there's this vociferous energy around, like, quote, canceling people, unquote, is because, I honestly believe this, it's because the government doesn't work. And all that energy that people, young people especially, but also non-white people and, you know, what we're calling this class of woke white people, I hate that term, it's just called being a human being who knows how America works. You're not woke, you're just American, and you understand what's wrong with this country. And you were doing your part because white people have to do the work. At some point, like, it's just not up to us. Like, we can say Black Lives Matter and all that stuff. It's important to have those people there. But Black Lives Matter is not in most legislatures doing the sort of dirty work of keeping the oppressed oppressed. They're pointing out the oppression. Most of the legislators are white people. Anyway. It's popular culture, it's art's job and popular culture's job to some extent to point out these things, I guess. But it's really this thing that we're going through right now in places like Twitter, in terms of calling people out for doing wrong stuff, comes, I think, almost entirely out of the frustration of being a citizen and a constituent part of a government that is, like, working against you or is sitting on its hands or is focused on a bunch of other stuff that has no direct bearing on your day-to-day life. So if you can exercise a different kind of electoral or populist power in a place like Twitter, you know, people, racists and sexual harassers, fired from their job, I mean, it's not the same thing as universal healthcare, but that energy, it comes out of the same place, and it's the energy of frustration, but it's also, like, there are results because the stuff works. Some of these people, like, do have their jobs taken away from them and have their careers changed. I don't think all the offenses are equal. I think some of them are really bad, and I think some of them are, like, y'all need to really try to get some universal healthcare passed because they're not the same. But the energy, I 100% understand where the energy comes from.
Let me ask you one more thing. It's the subject of your latest episode of Still Processing, the podcast. You're asking, you and Jen are sort of frustrated about the questions that are being posed to the candidates for running for president right now.
A lot of them are bad. They are asking, we did not say this to be fair, like, they are asking substantive policy questions, but a lot of it is like, we want to see you fight. We want to see like Elizabeth Warren smack Joe Biden down and ooh, Kamala Harris just went bussing on dope. You know, it's like, I just want to talk about what you guys are going to do about climate change. It's really my number one concern. I don't, there's nothing to fight about. I mean, y'all think the same thing. Like, anyway, go on. Sorry.
What's one question that you want to hear asked?
Oh, jeez. I have two qualifications for president. Like, truly, honestly, just two questions, two qualifications. Are you a racist? Because it isn't just about me and your racism. It's just about, like, what else your racism is going to lead to, right? Because your racism can go overseas. It can do all kinds of things if you are inclined to think and be this way. And the other thing is, like, what happens when you get off a plane in another country? Like, just that's it. Because most presidents hire people who will do a lot of the work, right? It's like the president's important job, but really it's like casting. Like, the president is really just a director, and like, who's working the camera, who's doing the editing, who's in the movie. I'm the vision, and you guys are going to execute the vision, but you kind of got to know what you're doing in your respective crafts and trades. But when the president gets off the plane someplace else and has to go to a state dinner, it's just him or her. And like, I don't want to deal with back rubs. I don't want to deal with like choking or vomiting or like accidentally starting a war or like, yo, I'm really close to the DMZ. You want to meet there? How cool would that be? Let's meet the DMZ. Oh my God. Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't know. Like, do you want to be stuck at a dinner party talking about that for like 4 years, or like having to apologize in every cab you get into for whatever thing that person did to these people's country? Those are the things that are most important to me. But, and so I don't really, beyond that, like the questions, I actually, to sort of flip it, is I don't have any Democrat questions, right? Like, I don't have any questions for the Democrats. They're just, you know, I actually want to see all those questions that Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo are asking the Democrats. Just take those exact questions and ask, like, if we ever get a debate between like Mark Sanford and, is it Joe Walsh?
Yeah.
Is that, like, if they ever actually have a debate, like, just take those questions and just ask the same questions, because I'm just curious about how that'll go. I do want to know, like, how those guys would actually seriously answer in 2019, having witnessed everything we've witnessed just in the last 4 years with the climate. Like, how you answer like a serious climate change question. Like, can you do anything about plastics? Can you do anything about recycling? I don't, like, none of the sort of social justice and race oriented questions. I don't, Democrats, they'll figure that out. Like, I really truly believe they'll definitely do better than what's happening right now. So that's why I'm not worried, right? The bar is like underground at this point. Like, I don't have any, like, I don't even think we should waste our time with debates with the Democrats, to be honest with you, because all they're looking for is excuses for people to drop out. That's a reality show over there. This is reality on the other side. Like, where do they stand on this stuff? Because it can't just be enough to be like, I think Donald Trump is a disgrace to my party. I want him to go so that I can do the job. I feel like a lot of a debate among those three people, I mean, if more people join, great. I think a lot of that debate's going to be about him. I don't think it's going to be too much about substance. I mean, look, I'm sure it will be, but I just can imagine a scenario where like classic Trump just like sucks all the oxygen out of the room and nobody talks about anything more than him. I'm not supposed to be talking about these things according to New York Times policy, but I'm sorry. I'm also a person who lives in this country. I care.
Wesley Morris, he's a critic at large for the New York Times. Next Wednesday, the activist Brittany Packnett will join us for the final event in our speaker series. You can get details by going to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our thanks to Bill Krim and Ashley Razan and the rest of the team at United Way of Salt Lake. Thanks also to KUER's Ale Vallarta. Natu Twe is our intern. The program is produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.